Hey everybody, it's Matt. I want to tell you about a special event coming up on June 12th, 2024. It's Future-Proof Your Workflows with TechSmith and AI. During the event, you're going to get exclusive previews of new features and get a chance to learn from industry pros and TechSmith experts. For all the details, make sure you visit us at bit.ly/TSC-June24. Remember, that's all lowercase, and we are so excited to have you join us and look forward to seeing you. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are and wherever you're watching from, whether you're watching us and joining us live or you're listening to the podcast, we're glad that you're here. Today, we've got another, as always, great episode. We're going to be talking about learning science and some myths around learning. And if you're thinking, well, what does that have to do with video? We're not going to talk specifically about video, but you can see the applications here because if you're doing learning creation, you're creating video for your customers or for your audience, it's important to understand kind of how you start, people start to learn so you can optimize for that with whatever you're using, whatever the tool is. So with that said, let me introduce today's guest. Clark Quinn, PhD, provides learning experience design strategy to corporations, higher education, government, and not-for-profit organizations. An award-winning consultant, internationally known speaker, and author of 6 books, he integrates a deep understanding of thinking and learning with technology to improve organizational execution, innovation, and ultimately performance. He learns out loud at learnlets.com, tweets as Quinnovator, and works on behalf of clients through Quinnovation. And with that, let me welcome Clark Quinn to the Visual Lounge. Welcome, Clark.
Hey, thanks, man. Good to see you.
Good to see you. So glad that you're here. And, you know, I'll just fanboy for a second. I have from afar watched you at conferences and honestly been intimidated to talk to you. But here's what changed. I heard you say that, you know, you're like, I like talking to people, but I'm just not the type to go up to people. And that opened a door for me. So I was really grateful for that because I've gone to your sessions. And I've learned a lot and always appreciative of your insight and leadership in the industry. So it's a real pleasure to have you with us today.
I appreciate that very much, Matt. Yeah, I'm a ham on stage. As soon as I get off stage, I'm an introvert. And it's like, will anybody talk to me? So I always love it when people reach out and chat.
Yeah. So today, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is because I think there's this whole world out there. You know, when I think about the people that might listen to this show, you know, they're probably making some kind of training or they're making visuals for a purpose. But there's a lot of things that are happening with, you know, learning that we might get wrong, or we maybe are misunderstanding, or maybe we just don't know. And so where I want to start is, let's start with learning science. We'll get to the myths because those are fun, but we'll do those in a little bit. So for those who maybe have never heard of learning science, what does that mean? Because I'm sure there's probably 12 definitions, but for you, what would you tell us?
Well, to me, learning science is a scientific study of learning, which would seem obvious, but it's interesting that it was relatively recently sort of identified as a field. So there were a lot of people talking about thinking. There's the philosophers and the linguists and the neuroscientists and the psychologists. And finally, they realized that they weren't talking to one another and they didn't know about each work. So they created something called the Cognitive Science Society. And this happened in essentially the early 80s. After that, another group of people, you know, people affiliated with that recognized that there was a bunch of people looking at learning. You have instructional design and educational psychologists and cognitive psychologists and artificial intelligence. And they said, we need to be talking to each other too. So they followed the model of the cognitive science in the early 90s. They created sort of the Learning Science Society. And that, while they're, you know, learning science has been going on for decades, if not centuries, that was sort of a stake in the ground about saying we're going to look cross-disciplinarily at learning. And that's, to me, what really learning science is. And it's following the paradigms of a number of different component disciplines, but having that dialogue back and forth and saying, let's unpack learning and, of course, the applications of that to the design of instruction.
Yeah. So it's interesting because as you're saying this, one of the things that happened when I was just about to finish up grad school, so early 2000s, my school actually was building and starting a learning science department. You know, we had our like instructional systems technology department, which was really focused on instructional design, education, you know, working with K-12, also with business. And then they that interdisciplinary kind of approach started to form. So that's super interesting. So we think about the learning of science as what this is like, you know, how all learning happens from a scientific approach. If I'm at home and I'm listening to this and I'm saying, well, why does it matter? I'm in a workplace. Why does that matter to me? What might we say to say why this is important for businesses or for people in kind of professional field versus academia?
A couple important reasons in my mind. One of the, if we follow an instructional design paradigm, there isn't one that can account for all situations. And so when there's gaps between what they specify, should we do this or this? There may not be specific prescriptions. You have to make inferences. If you don't have a good basis to make those inferences, you can get them wrong. So that's one of the arguments, is be able to fill in the gaps to connect and understand the what's going on behind this instructional design approach so I can adapt it to different situations. Another really important one is be able to resist a lot of the hype that goes on. People push a lot of ideas and products and paradigms that they want to sell you. And a lot of this is, frankly, snake oil. It really is just stuff they've made up and are flogging, and there's no real basis for it, or the basis is fundamentally flawed or doesn't stand up to, you know, statistical analysis. So there's a lot of stuff people are being told to do that once you understand how our brains actually process information and turn that into learning, you're able to resist a lot more. So it gives you better basis, which saves you money, and then it keeps you from spending money on, you know, snake oil. So they're sound basis. And at the end of the day, what you create has a higher likelihood of having the impact you're trying to achieve. Part of this is also an awareness of we're not about just dumping information. That turns out, you know, the old model of the brain was that we're these formal logical reasoning beings. And therefore, if we give us new information, you know, bullet points and stuff, we'll change the way we behave. And it turns out that's just so wrong. So you really need to understand learning science to be able to design instruction that's actually going to lead to a meaningful change. And you should be trying for that in your practices.
Yeah, that makes so much sense to me. And I love that. You know, I've never changed because of bullet points. In fact, I probably resist the bullet point changes because of the bullet points. So, you know, you mentioned these, you know, being able to learn how to make inferences because not any one model will cover all situations. And I know there's a vast amount of information, and we don't have time nor probably the energy to go through all the things that learning science has found. But from a high level, are there one to maybe three things that you found that, like, these are really important starting points for someone to learn about learning science that will help them, you know, go and apply or, you know, be able to make better decisions about whatever they're creating? You know, are there key ones that, like, the field has said, like, hey, starting off, you need to know X and maybe Y?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a couple things. So I'm going to frame this. I'm going to give you two different lists and I'll explain them. The first one is sort of what do you really need to know? And I start in my recent book on learning science, after the introduction, really the most important thing is that human information processing loop. So we understand our brains operate at a neural level, but that's not a useful level for analysis or for prescriptions of instruction, because the way it's not you can't address individual neurons. You activate patterns in neurons. And the way you do that is through words and images. Therefore, that's the right level to be thinking about how do we activate learning. And that's at a cognitive level. So if you understand the human information processing loop, which is basically the cognitive explanation of how we think, you have a really good basis. It covers things like perception and immediate sensation, which is, of course, relevant to your video audience.
Mm-hmm.
And then attention and what gets into working memory and what working memory will get into long-term memory. That's basically what learning is. And then the ability to use that, retrieving that from long-term memory. And what do you automate? So understanding that core process, and then on top of that, understanding some of the fundamental emergent properties of that architecture. There are a lot of properties of that architecture, a subset of which are relevant to learning. And that takes me over to the other list. What are the sort of implications you should know? And the sort of top implications I think we miss. The first one is the importance of practice. How important it is to do contextualized, meaningful application of the knowledge in the way you're going to need to apply it outside the learning experience. And we don't do that enough. We do a lot of knowledge tests. You know, here's this stuff. Show me you can recite it back. Surely that's going to lead to you doing something differently. No. You need to be applying that knowledge, making decisions, using it to solve problems. When you elaborate it in and pull it out in practice, and there's parameters around practice that matter, like the importance of spacing and the importance of variability and the importance of the right level of challenge. When you get a good practice, everything else follows from that really nicely. Another thing that I think we misunderstand, that's not the right word, but I know what I mean. Yeah, mental models. The importance of having models to allow us to predict what's going to be the outcome of this decision and what's going to be the outcome of that decision so we can make better decisions. And I will, on my editorial soapbox, suggest that what's going to make a difference to your and your audience's organizations is not the ability to recite facts more accurately. It's going to be the ability to make better decisions, particularly in this increasingly, you know, volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous environments we're heading into and going through. The ability to make better decisions, I'm going to suggest, is going to be the important contributor to organizational success, and the ability to create a basis for that comes from mental models, which are causal, explanatory, simplifications of the world that give us a basis to make those predictions and therefore those decisions.
That's a lot. Like, there's a lot to unpack in there, and I can, you know, I'm guessing you have given us the very distilled version, which is great though, because I love that you split it into two, because I think the first one, you know, thinking about how the processes work, starting to think about that, there's a lot of structural things you can then start to think about and how information's delivered. I'm going to be honest, I'm not a learning science expert. I've gone to your sessions, I've tried to learn, but I'm not there yet. I'm working on it. But I love that. And I love that you said thinking with what the words are and the images that help kind of convey that information makes a lot of sense. But then, you know, it makes me think when I'm creating stuff and I'm thinking of myself as a creator here, am I allowing you am I just giving you information? Because if we're just giving information, that's not really great, right? That's what I heard. So we need to allow opportunities for that practice, I'll allow that opportunity to get better. And the decision-making is absolutely right. So as I'm thinking about this and I'm like, okay, Clark gave me the five minute maybe overview. How does one go about learning these things in a way that they can then apply it? Because I worry that one, we can talk about this at a high level and it's really great. Sounds cool. Mm-hmm. Sounds like, yep, that makes sense. But the challenge being for most of us as professionals is now, I think sometimes there's that gap between like, I learned stuff as a theory, like in grad school, right? Now I've got to go and practice it. So what's the transfer look like to get to that point where you can understand this enough to actually be applying it in a way that makes sense and not going to be making maybe grave or faulty errors?
Yeah, I want to make one point of coming from what you said first and then address that. You said, you're only scratching the surface and it goes so much deeper. Yes, and there are a fairly finite set of things that if you get your mind around, you're going to greatly increase your ability to perform. So it's not like you have to understand all of neuro and cognitive science. We've got some pretty basic things, and that's, you know, what I wrote in the book and what I cover in workshops and things. And so the follow-on answer to your question is the best way to really understand it is to experience it. And so what I've got in the book, what I do in workshops is I do the experiments and ask you to experience the phenomena that I'm talking about. And then I talk about what are the implications. And, you know, in a workshop, I try and draw it out of you, say, what does that therefore imply about design? But what you should do as a learner for anything you hear, learning science and everything else, is go, well, what would that mean I would do differently? So start exercising that knowledge, pulling it out and applying it in your context. And when you, and that's the lovely thing, is when you're trying to apply it in your context, you go, oh, wait, that's when you stop and interrupt and go, hey, wait, clearly I don't understand this because I'm running into this mental thing. And that's how you start creating a learning dialogue. So conversation is a really powerful communication mechanism as a way to negotiate understanding. But really, people have to be active in the learning. It's not like passive, yes, I can design. Have you experienced the phenomenon to design some application exercise? And we do that. But also, you have to be active in learning. That's where we get into the meta learning. How do you become a better learner knowing this stuff? By the way, that's a third benefit of this, besides saving money and resisting snake oil, is also to self-improve your own learning. Because once you understand it, you can optimize your learning experience. But that's it. You have to be an active learner, be applying it, thinking about the implications for yourself, and then using that opportunity to go, oh, wait, that shows me I didn't really understand this because I can't answer that question. Now let me ask that question. Does that help?
That, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The mental model, kind of thinking about your own learning, and I'm trying to think of a better word, but I'm thinking like it's like a way to hack your learning, right? Like if you know the process, you can start figuring out where to optimize and what to change. And so I think that's really, really great. And I love that it's a dialogue process. It's almost applying the thing that you just talked about, right? Like we're not just going to go and do it. We're going to practice, and we're going to learn through that practice and then develop. So I think that's really an exciting concept. And I'm thinking about application for folks who might be listening to this, typically using like Camtasia and Snagit and thinking like, okay, we often talk about getting better at those tools and learning those tools. And it's the thing I always talk about. It's practice, right? You learn the tool through practice. So I'm curious, Clark, you talked about the snake oil stuff, and we're going to talk about myths, but I'm curious because I think a lot of people in the field of learning development, and there's this kind of bigger field, and there's probably people outside of that field listening, but there's, you know, when you talk about snake oil, what are the things that we're seeing that are problematic? Because I think it's helpful to identify that so we can then, you know, not have to, you know, like worry about it.
There are a number of things people will try and sell you, ways to simplify learners based upon learning styles or personality characteristics stuff. And a lot of these are proprietary and they're flawed. If you go back and look at the research that unpacks it, but there are also just a lot of myths about what's effective. You know, so there's Dale's cone. We learn, you know, remember 10% of what we read, but 90% of what we do. It turns out that's not an accurate analysis. Yes, doing is more important than reading, but we don't have good numbers on that. It's so variable by depending on what we're studying. And we'll hear things like, you know, oh, generations learn differently. There's no evidence of that. And besides the generation. So there's just a lot of ideas promoted that don't have in the visual space. Oh, we process images 60,000 times faster than words. A word is a visual. Let's be clear. Unless it's auditory, but that's a different modality. And we're talking apples and oranges. What was the other one? I just read somebody was talking. It was the 1090 thing, but this time it was text versus video. And while we'd like to believe that because we're, you know, your audience is largely involved in visual, there's just no data that supports that. It's a ridiculous claim. How do you know what claims are valid or not, or an important outcome of having a basis in learning science and a little bit of understanding about how research is done and what's valid research and what's not? So I really want to emphasize that there are a lot of things that we are being told and are continuing to be repeated that are just bunk, yeah. Or to use a phrase, malarkey.
Whoa, getting strong language here, malarkey. Yes. You know, I it's interesting because I've had these conversations at TechSmith even, right? Like as we're going to, because we want to promote obviously video and visuals. They are important modalities along with lots of other modalities, you know. But I remember having particularly like there was a goal attention myth, right? Your attention, you have a shorter attention than a goldfish, right? And I started doing the personally, and I think this was before I found your work, I was like, going back through the links and trying to figure out where did that come from. And it was just this web of circling around and never really definitive. And but it's a great point that there's lots of things that we get told, and maybe we need to be cautious about taking things, you know, without a grain of salt. We need a grain of salt with it.
Well, it's interesting. The attention span of a goldfish, actually, it does go around in a circle, but it does end at a place at that you can identify, and then you can identify why it's bloody wrong. It turns out, so it was attributed to Microsoft Canada, but it turns out it was actually Microsoft Marketing Canada, because Microsoft Canada, you might say Microsoft, you know, that's, and Canada's just, you know, isn't going to be really fundamentally different, but it was Microsoft Marketing. And they had copied it from a company called StatBrain that produces marketing data, you know, marketing statistic and hype. They had gotten it from a study done in Germany where they'd looked at how long people spent on a web page, and then several years later, they decided to go back and look and found out that people were spending less time on web pages. And StatBrain stupidly went, oh, that means we're our attention span has dropped, instead of going, well, are there any other explanations? Like maybe pages load faster. Maybe we have gotten several years better at interpreting whether a web page is worth paying attention to or not. All sorts of other things. So they, and where they brought, got the attention span of a goldfish, we don't know how to measure the attention span of a goldfish. We know they can remember things because when you come back to feed them, there they are at the top going, oh, I see the hand coming and I'm going to go up and get my food. They've even taught goldfish to drive vehicles. That was just recently in the news. In Israel, they created a special tank that had things that could detect the goldfish motion and would react, steer on it. And they, by reinforcing the goldfish, got them to drive to the end of a room, you know, as a goal. So they have memory, but we still don't know attention. And attention's complex. You know, I would bet your audience, most of your audience, if not all of them, have had the experience that being watching a movie or reading a novel or playing a computer game and surfacing going, oh my, where did the time go? It was bloody more than 8 seconds, right?
Yeah, for sure.
There's a lot that goes into it, but that simplistic response is just not helpful. There are lots of ways you find different myths come from different origins or different beliefs, but they end up, you know, dying on the shoal of research.
Yeah, and I want to keep talking about myths, but a question came in that before we get too far down the myth path, I want to talk about learning science. One of our listeners, Christy, he says, "What is better?" So he's given us some options here: an approach where only the minimal information is provided for a task or learning gap, or a more elaborate learning unit that also provides more possibly redundant context. So there's probably a lot in there. Without context, it's hard to answer. But
In general, the minimal information provided is best. Anything else can add to cognitive load. Now, that's not stuff that's automatically processed. So it turns out abstract problems, we don't learn as well from, we don't transfer the information as well. So making it contextualized, putting it in a real setting. So we shouldn't just ask multiple choice questions to ask for recall. We should put it in the form of a little story that they have to respond to in choices of decisions. That, so we can dress up that context with stuff that gets processed pretty much subconsciously. And so it's not interfering with our cognitive load. So we can set it in a bakery and we can just have, you know, we could have the smell of bread. We could have the sight of loaves and ovens. We're going to process it without really adding to the cognitive load. But if we have a bunch of extraneous music, we have some images that are, decorations on the bakery wall that are, we would have to process to understand why they had chosen that. That stuff can interfere. So you do want a context, but you don't want stuff that requires additional processing on top of the learning processing, because you should be designing the challenge and the learning task to be difficult enough that they don't need any additional challenge. You know, how many of, I'm sure you and your audience have seen, I like to ask this question in presentations, how many of you have seen a quiz question where the alternative to the right answer is so silly or obvious that you didn't have to actually have learned anything to be able to get it right?
Oh,
everybody
for sure.
Raises,
raises
their hand. No learning benefit to that at all. So put the challenge in the question, put it in a context, provide the minimal resources to help them understand the context, Let them focus on the decision. I hope that's a good answer for Christy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good answer. And it makes me think about, I'm pulling back to my grad school days a long time ago, but it makes me think of the one of the theories I actually remember a lot about is Vygotsky, zone of proximal development, right? Where you're looking to find, basically there's too much, there's too little, and you're trying to find that right spot. And it sounds like if I'm understanding you, Clark, is that in that case, you want to find the right spot, the right amount of information, not too much extra, but you're not also just paring it down to its absolute bare minimum where there's no real learning happening.
Well, actually, that's two different things in a sense. Okay. So one is cognitive load. So there's the intrinsic cognitive load of the task you're having them do. And there's the cognitive load of using the interface and stuff. And then anything else is extraneous cognitive load. And you only have so much cognitive resources. So you need to keep the everything that's required to be processed within their capability. Otherwise, you overload it. And gratuitous graphics. The desirable difficulty, remember I said that the challenge in the question should be right? That's that zone of proximal development. It's been known as desirable difficulty. I think that's Bjork or I'm trying to remember what Anders Ericsson called it. I'm getting his name wrong. But anyways, Ericsson talked about, in peak, having the right challenge. And actually, so zone of proximal development is nice. And it actually turns out, if you look at Csikszentmihalyi's flow, he has that same diagram. Too simple and it's boring. Too hard and it's frustrating. In between is the zone where you're in full engagement. The same thing with learning, with Vygotsky. If it's too simple, it's boring. If it's too hard, it's frustrating. In between is where learning happens. You get that alignment. Turns out learning can and should be hard fun.
Yeah. Well, I love that. And, my 15-year-old is learning guitar, and it's really interesting to see, like, when he progresses. And he hasn't been playing for very long, but, like, it is hard, right? Like, but it's not so hard, the things he's trying to do, because that's just frustrating and he stops. But when it's so easy, he's bored and then he doesn't practice. So it's interesting to make that correlation. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go on to a few other things with some of the myths, because, we talked about a few of them. From your perspective and, just your opinion on this, like what have these myths, whether it's a goldfish or big one, learning styles, right? Like we know that's a problem one we could talk about, but like what impact do you think this actually has when these get perpetuated and tried to be enforced inside of learning and, learning content creation, I guess.
Right. On the big picture, they can waste time. We invest effort in accommodating these, and it doesn't help. So we've wasted additional resources on something we didn't need to expend it on. It can waste money in the same way, but it can also be damaging. It can undermine our learning effectiveness, so we could actually decrease the impact of our intervention. But I think of something like learning styles. What we see, somebody will go, oh, I'm a X. I'm either, I'm an NSFW, but they may say I'm an INTJ or an ESTP, whatever it is, or I'm a visual learner or I'm an auditory learner. As soon as they say that, they've closed themselves off. And it turns out under different contexts, we're more than one thing. The MBTI stuff is debunked both fundamentally because Jung just made that stuff up anyway. He admits it. So there's not a good theoretical basis, but it's not as psychometrically invalid as well. It doesn't pass all the tests for validity. When it's done independently, they claim, oh, our studies say this, but they won't publish them in peer. Oh, because it's proprietary. As soon as you hear proprietary be word, and there are better personality instruments that are open, being done by research scientists in open ways like Ocean and now Hexaco. Go look those up if you're really interested in personality psychology. But when you label yourself that way, you can close yourself. I'm a visual learner. Oh, this is auditory. I can't learn from it. You can't learn music visual. You really have to be auditory unless you're tone deaf like me and you're just hopeless. But there are a lot of potential ways in which you could constrain yourself and limit yourself and not be open to all the different ways you could learn. And so not only is there a waste of time and money, but it actually can be harmful in that sense and others. And so I think we need to be aware of the limitations of these things and avoid wasting time and money. The same way the categorization of generations. Oh, millennials are like this, and you know, and boomers are like that. You know, our colleague Jane Bozarth goes, I'm the oldest living millennial because, you know, she's technically sophisticated. I help my kids with tech problems. They're in their 20s. They're supposed to be the experts, right? It's so much more individual, and our brains like to categorize things, but it isn't always helpful. Sometimes these simplifications are on false basis and lead us down wrong, you know, tracks.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that because I know, again, just I've come in contact with some of these thinking, and it's difficult, right? Because I think we do, like you said, we do want to categorize. We do want to have options of saying that, because it just the simplification, like I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think our brains, we like to simplify because it just makes things easier, right? It's less load, less taxing to understand. Mm-hmm. Well, this, you know, in a lot of ways, this age group is like this. And which, you know, it's probably categorically wrong because they're not, none of us are the same, right? Like we all, I look at my oldest who's in college, and he is not like a lot of his peers in that sense. Like he doesn't have social media. He barely uses his phone. Like, so he's not like a typical kind of, I guess he's technically Gen Z, but I'm curious from your perspective, because I still do see some of these things, and I know you and many others have been working to help share kind of the understanding of why these things aren't real. But when we see it, you know, someone says, well, I'm a visual learner. TechSmith wishes that we wish that was true, right? Like, cause we've got perfect tools for that. But when someone says, oh, I'm a visual learner, or someone's going to create a training, I'm going to make this for the visual learners. How can we gracefully, because I don't want to be mean about it, but how can we gracefully help point them in the right way?
So that's what I tried to do. So my book before my learning science book was on myths. And I tried to acknowledge, I think the most important thing to do is first acknowledge the appeal. You know, yeah, visuals can be engaging. We have good visual architecture. But if you look in your experience, there are certain things, riding a bicycle wasn't so much visual, and yet you probably learned to do it. And what, so you first acknowledge it, and then you sort of go, what I did in the book, what are some of the dangers of that view, and what are the benefits of that view? So you're setting up, we understand both sides. If this is true, here's the benefit. If it's not true, here's the harm. And then you say, what does the research say? Okay, you know, so you've acknowledged it, you've looked at the appeal, you've helped them recognize that there are two sides because it's easy to only think there's one side. Well, what would be the harm if we did that? We could prematurely limit ourselves. What would be the advantage? Well, we could design learning for different types of learning. And then you say, what does the research say? The research says that we can't reliably identify the different styles, and there's no evidence that adapting to styles works. Now, there are benefits to doing things in multiple media. So there are benefits to having video and some pros, but it's not because of learning styles. It's because different types of learning goals and different types of content require different types of presentation. Video is a very flexible medium. So you can particularly capture dynamic context, which oftentimes is what people need. But if you need dynamic concept, an animation is better than a video. And I'm being pedantic and separating out different types of video. I think an animation is not the same thing as watching you in video as I'm doing right now, right?
Absolutely agree.
So understanding the properties of the media and when they play a role is a much more powerful way to use media appropriately, and then understand the power of mixing it up to support variety. We know maintaining attention helps engagement and learning. So having a variety is good, but trying specifically designed for different learning styles isn't useful and is therefore a waste of resources, instead of saying, how do we use the media appropriately to meet our learning goals?
Yeah. So, I love that, right? Because you're not getting rid of the visuals. You're not saying don't use video or don't use audio, auditory means. You're saying what is appropriate for this, and does it help us solve the problem and engage the person to keep them focused and learning. So okay. I think that's great. That helps, because I know there's, these myths are very sticky, right? Like I feel like there's, good marketing. Like, they've got good marketing. It's like some of those things you hear, like, it's a jingle and it's an earworm and it just sticks. And you're like, oh gosh, I wish that wouldn't stick.
And they get perpetuated. And again, they have that appeal. And our brains are constantly running in the background. New cognitive research shows that our brains are continually making models to explain the world. So having somebody present us with a model that seems to be explanatory is very appealing. And it seems to resonate with our personal experience. Oh, I really like that visual, you know, and we may have preferences, but it turns out appealing to preferences doesn't lead to better outcomes. And that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, one other question, I'm going to shift back to just to kind of general learning sciences. I'm curious, because I know you're keeping your eyes on the pulse of what's going on. Is there anything exciting that's happening in the world of research right now that you think, man, this has really some implications for how we design or how we create learning experiences?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, to me, there's a few trends that I think are coming out of cognitive science and learning sciences that I think are going to have interesting implications. One is the notion of distributed cognition. We have this notion that it's all in our head. And yet the work of Ed Hutchins with his book Cognition in the Wild talked about how we use external resources as part of our problem-solving process. We use spreadsheets because we can't keep all these details in our head. And they combine the models and give us ability to do calculations. We use calculators. We use external tools like checklists and things. There are a lot of ways we support our thinking with tools. And when we recognize this, it allows us to start designing solutions for performance that says what can be in the world and what has to be in the head. And we can stop trying to put everything in the head, which is extremely hard to get things reliably out of our brain. And if we can put it in the world, then you look at Atul Gawande's checklist manifesto. So distributed cognition is one. The situated notion of cognition, the fact that we're very context dependent, means we have to understand that and design our learning to provide appropriate context in our practice and examples that we can transfer appropriately to the situations they'll need to see in the outside world. Recognizing that we don't, once we formally understand it, we will formally apply it appropriately in all contexts. Bugwash. It just doesn't work that way. And so understanding how much we're tied into the context and the importance of that for the design of our learning. One other one that is relatively new to me, and it came from Annie Murphy Paul's book, The Extended Mind, was embodied cognition. How much our motion and, we used to think of our five senses, and touch was one. And yet it turns out that unpacks in some very interesting things. So there's the touch of external, but also the fact that you can close your nose and touch your finger. Close your eyes and touch your finger to your nose. Close your nose and touch your finger to your eyes. means that there's some sort of internal system that you're using to do that. We call that proprioceptive learning. And we can use that as part of our cognition. And they're finding out that having people physically embody stuff, what Dave Gray called game storming. So people are actually moving through processes. And the importance of gesture in supporting learning. Not that this, you've got to keep your hands in your pockets or at your sides, but the use of gestures actually increases learning. When we begin to understand these phenomena that are outgrowths of our cognitive architecture, we end up with better tools in our repertoire, quivers in our, arrows in our quiver to be able to design learning experiences that are going to be most effective.
Oh, that's fascinating and exciting to see all the things that how we've progressed. And it feels like, in the 20 years since I was in a master's program in theories, and I still see a lot of the fundamental things in place, but it's exciting to see that we're opening up to even more and learning so much more. And it's an exciting time to be in the field of learning and development. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. It's not that difficult. I'm having this debate with my colleague, Matt Richter from the Learning Development Accelerator about, should we be helping people learn how to read the research in its original academies and journals, or should we be helping them find the translator? So, what we do in that organization is we're trying to provide evidence-based programs, but not the pure research, but instead what are the implications? I think finding the good translators of research is really important. There are some you should pay attention to and some people who would like you to pay attention to them that you really shouldn't. But when we see some, there are a number of people who have reliably demonstrated the ability to give us good advice. That's the Will Tallheimer and Patty Shank and Julie Dirksen and Connie Melamed and Jane Bozarth, and the list goes on. But these are people who have, who read the stuff in the original academies, have been trained to do that, and have the practical real world experience to help you understand how to apply that, you know. And I hope I try to be in that coterie as well. I think it's important to see what those people are pointing to, or saying, yes, this is good, or no, this is bogus, and check with them on anything somebody's trying to flog you. What is their vested interest? And what do others say, including the people who've demonstrated a track record? If somebody's coming in and going, oh, learning styles, is anybody saying to the alternate, are they, do they have a vested interest? Yeah. Be asking yourself those questions.
Yeah. And that list of individuals, I have heard most of them speak in person. I've gotten to know some of them on a personal level, and I can vouch that I think they're all very good at what you call the translation process. And, you know, just for reference for this show, if you want to hear Jane Bozar, she was on the show last month or so. She actually helped do some research for us, worked with us on some research, and she is very knowledgeable on those things. So we'll just give a shout out to Jane.
Yeah. I have a list of translators on my site. If you have a way to get links to people after this thing, I can get it to you and you can get it out to them. But it's just at Quinnovation, there's a is a list of translators. I think it comes from either or both of the Mystbook or the Learning Science book. If you look at the book page on the site, there's a link to the translators. And there's a few more than I mentioned that, of course, my brain forgets in the heat of the moment.
Right.
It's a pretty good list, I think. You know.
Yeah, we'll get that link from you, and we'll put it into the show notes for the podcast, as well as on the links for the YouTube channel and elsewhere. So,
excellent.
You know, Clark, as we're kind of getting close to time here, and I want to be respectful of your time, I guess, as you know, we've talked about some of the kind of future stuff. We've talked about the myths. We've talked about, you know, what learning science is. I guess from – we'll still do our speed round here in just a second, but I'm curious, kind of as a ending of the talking about the learning science directly, is there anything else you think that would help us to embrace learning science, to understand where we can apply it? Just kind of last parting words about what we should know.
Well, I guess it's not going to be it's more an admonition, and sorry to be so Puritan schoolmarmish, but in my mind, it's a professional obligation.
Please.
If we are supposed to be the people who design learning experiences for others, we bloody well ought to understand learning, just as you expect your plumber to understand the properties of pipes and your doctor to understand the properties of the body. We should understand learning if we're going to be doing this responsibly, and not to a learning scientist level. We don't expect you to go get a PhD in it, but we expect you to have enough of an understanding so that you can discriminate between useful investments and snake oil.
A great admonition. I think a super important one. And I, you know, going back to what you said too about, like, you don't have to necessarily be the people to learn to read the academic. I will say, as much as I love the translators as well, having at least a basic ability to at least look at it and start to gather some of the understanding. And then it's like using a language, right? Like, I go to the translator and say, like, did I understand that right? So I think it's a great admonition though. And it's a tough one, right? And I would say also that, you know, it's like using, if you're going to use a tool, whatever tool, whether it's Microsoft PowerPoint or Word, it's the same type of thing. Learn to use the tools of your craft so that you can create the appropriate experiences. And same with the learning, we're meshing those tools and the learning experiences together, and you want to make sure that that's worth the time of the people, because it's a lot of money to train people. It costs a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's great if you can read academies. The problem is there's so many journal articles published, you want to find the best ones that are, you know, sort of the primary sources that everybody else cites, and the way you find those are from the translator. And a lot of, increasingly we're seeing books that digest this down. So, you know, Medina's Brain Rules or Roediger, McDaniels and Brown's Make It Stick. And so there are a lot of condensations becoming available that are also helpful, and just finding those that are translation, Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, a bit of a heavy read, but just because it's so voluminous, but it's very useful in getting your mind around it. it's worth a skim.
I don't know. Absolutely. Cover to cover. Absolutely. Well, yeah. we all have some homework to do. We got some reading to do. So go look at the translators. Before we wrap up today's show, though, we like to do what we call our speed round. Clark, we've already talked about this, but this is a short, quick, fast answers. No pain. There's only one really hard question, and it's the same question we ask everybody. So it's not just you. So let's jump into our speed round. All right, Clark, first question for you. It's a yes, no question. Or, well, it's a short answer, and then it's going to be, we'll just go with it. Is there a myth that you wish was true, but it just isn't? And which one is that?
Actually, I wish learning styles was true. I wish we could reliably identify the best learning approach for individual learners as opposed to for the individual learning. It would be really nice if it were there. It just hasn't yet. And I have to carefully qualify it as a trained scientist. We haven't yet found any basis to do it, but it would be lovely if we could optimize learning for the learner. It just, there isn't any solid basis to do so yet.
Yeah. All right. Next question. What is the technology that has surprised you by its application in learning design and development? So anything that's like, oh my gosh, that's, I would not have expected that.
Positively or negatively?
Either.
Right. Yeah, I remember Second Life and now VR in that, you know, immersive environments, we could do such powerful learning in it. And then you end up seeing PowerPoint presentations in Second Life and it's like, kill me now. What a waste of technology. I'm afraid that the same is happening in VR. I think AR is extremely cool. I think that the ability to annotate the world with hidden information is, to me, one of the most fascinating opportunities. It's still problematic, both of them, because we don't have standards, we don't have interoperability, but I think when we get that, I think there's going to be some really interesting opportunities to meet individual interests and needs.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, next, and really, then there's two questions left. This one's pretty easy, next one's a little harder. Where do you turn for inspiration? So you're a learning scientist, you are obviously reading a ton, I'm sure looking at tons of sources, but where's your inspiration that you turn to?
I don't know why I find learning so interesting, but it once I started exploring it and applying it, so, you know, I guess I'm a geek, I like shiny objects, but I like helping people and putting those together and saying, how can we use technology to help people achieve their goals better is the underlying, I guess, passion that drives me. And then, you know, how do we design, you know, learning, engagement, and design, and understanding the underpinnings of those and applying those practically is what inspires me. And I, who knows why, some traumatic experience in my life.
Well, we love it. We're appreciative that you are such a learning geek. It's helped us, the industry, I think, just really level up our abilities and what we're able to do. So last question for you. What's a question you'd like to ask me as we wrap up today? So you get to turn the tables.
Right. So how does Camtasia strike a balance between learning science and what the market wants? I have talked with other vendors and they go, we only listen to what our customers want. We're not giving them what they need. And I would love to hear an answer a bit more forward thinking than that.
Yeah. I hope I have a better answer. You know, obviously at any business, there's some element of listening to customers and we love our customers and we try to listen to you. However, I think there is a level of, we also know that many of the users of Camtasia are trying to do something that's focused on learning. And so trying to make sure that we can provide them with the tools that will make that simple and allow them to make something that is effective, but is simple as well. We have lots of great, cool features, but helping them to understand that they don't have to do that. And I think that comes across in the fact that not only do we make a great product, we also try to do things like this, have conversations about what is learning science. We talk about what is good design. We try to teach the principles that allow people to hopefully do that. But at the end of the day, we are also trying to make a really great product that can do lots of things for a lot of different people. And so sometimes we probably fall down on making something that's good for learning science. Although, you know, teach correct principles and then let people govern themselves, as I say.
Fair enough. Thank you.
So we try. We try. And hopefully everyone's listening to this and they say, like, oh, maybe I don't need to do all the fancy things. I just need to make sure it's focused. But then you got the marketer who does want to do fancy things. So, you know, always a balance.
Why are you?
Well, Clark, thank you so much for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to get to listen to you and learn from you. And if anyone wanted to connect with you, what are the key places they can find you and read more of your stuff?
My blog posts appear on LinkedIn as well. You can go to my blog, learnthis.com. Things that end up in books and presentations usually show up there first. It's really helpful if you need help sleeping at night. Great tool. the quinnovation.com is the way to reach me. Again, LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter is at Quinnovator, as you mentioned at the beginning. So most of the social media places.
Perfect. Well, thank you once again, Clark, and we always appreciate it. So guys, go check out everything that Clark is doing and listen to the things that he's got to say, and don't get sucked in by the snake oil. Put that off. So we appreciate everybody tuning in every single week. We're grateful for our audience that listens on the podcast. And if you've got questions, thoughts, things that you would like to ask us or share with us, or things, guests that you would like to see, you can email us at thevisuallounge@techsmith.com or tag us on social media at techsmith.com. With that said, whatever you're doing, wherever you are, whether you're like making images, videos, creating training based on learning science, we hope you take a little time every week to level up. And we'll see you next week. Thanks.